Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. And today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Shweta Bikram. She is the author of yet another book of poetry, and this one is called Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors. Until I personally read Shweta's wonderful work, I had no idea that in her Hindu culture, colors that women wear had such a deep meaning. So stay tuned, because we're going to get into some of the colors and the emotional aspects that sometimes result from being in the grid. But first, a little bit about Shweta. Shweta Bikram, a graduate of Columbia University, is a multi-genre writer and a marketing professional living in New York City. Her work has appeared in 6 countries across 3 continents. Hi, Shweta.
Hi, Irene.
So good to be talking to you again. Gosh, and I love your work. I just love your work. Your wordsmithing is tremendous.
And thank you so much for having me on the show again. It's always a joy talking to you.
Well, today it's exciting because we're going to be talking about colors. And, you know, all our societies have something to do with color at one point or another, more so than others. And for the listening audience, I just want to read something out of your introduction, and that's the direction we're going to go into right now.
Okay.
And what you say is, Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors, delves into the implication and philosophy of colors from a Hindu woman's point of view, from birth until death. The color she adorns herself with almost depicts the story of her life. Wow. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the progression of colors that women do wear and surround themselves with, and why.
You know, I think globally across every culture, colors play a very vital role. We might not consciously think about them, but they do play a role. And, you know, given we're talking about Kaleidoscope and Asian Journey of Colors, I'll, you know, restrict my point of view to Hindu women at this point. You know, when I look at what a Hindu bride wears, there's a lot of red colors, you know, red bangles, vermilion in her hair, a red dot, which we call as bindi. All these colors are there, and, you know, even before the wedding happens, you wear different shades, because a yellow might denote, it's called haldi. It's a custom where turmeric is applied as a paste on the bride, which is supposed to be auspicious. So you have all these colors, these shades, and once she gets pregnant, within certain communities there, women wear green, because that's considered the color of fertility. And it just got me thinking that, you know, there are these colors, there are traditions behind them, but we haven't consciously considered that generation after generation we embrace these colors. But aside from the societal point of view, what about the emotions that women go through? So on one hand, you know, as red is the color for a Hindu bride, what about the emotions, or, you know, if it's a traditional arranged marriage, the confusion or anger, any of those emotions, they are red too, because they're related to the heart. Mm-hmm. And in terms of green, which is the color of conception, what about envy? Yeah, I mean, I don't have kids, but I've spoken with my friends who have children, and, you know, they've said to me there are times it's difficult to just carry yourself around. So there's, or what about a woman who cannot have a child? So there's some level of envy attached. So that's green too. So my point being, and I hope to bring out in this book, that aside from what the society sets as standards for colors, there are emotions also in colors that accompany a woman, in this case, a Hindu woman, throughout her life.
So, Shweta, I'm curious, do you know where these colors came from? Where did they originate originally? Let's say when you're talking about the bride wears red. So where did this come from?
You know, I have to be honest, it's one of those things that even I don't know, but I know, like, I've seen my grandmother's wedding pictures, both on my maternal and paternal side, and they were red, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine it's one of those really old traditions, and the irony is, just looking at all the colors in the closet of a Hindu woman, people marvel at them. But having said that, once she is a widow, she wears white. Okay, in today's day and age, things might have changed, and, you know, women might not exactly wear white, but she still goes on with pastel shades.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she doesn't wear a bindi or bangles any longer. So as if losing that loved person in your life wasn't bad enough, your wardrobe is expected to be barren as well.
It's interesting that you say white, because in other cultures, women wear black.
Right.
You know, so until maybe 6 months are up, or a year or 2 years, and it depends on their beliefs and the culture and religion. And so there you go. You know, it's just very interesting as to how that, we'd be curious to know how the white was chosen for the widow. But, yeah, you know, you had mentioned about the emotional, and I'm just thinking, wow, it's like you're labeled.
You are, and, you know, I mean, what gets me thinking is it almost, the presence or absence of a man in a woman's life almost determines what color she can wear. And that's what got me thinking, that the fact is on a macro level it might not seem that way, but when you think of it, she wears a red, you know, when she's marrying this man. She's pregnant, green be the color of fertility, you know, and then she's a widow and she ends up wearing white. So where is a woman's choice in this? And what, how is it her fault if, you know, if her husband passes away? That's more, I mean, that's enough of a trauma to deal with.
Exactly.
But to be labeled as such. Mm-hmm. And you know, in today's day and age, I know I can speak for my family, it's not one of those traditional families. And my father especially is a very forward-thinking man who's absolutely against any of these, you know, stigmas or stringent traditions. But having said that, like, I've seen my aunt, no one told her to, you know, go into wearing pastels or any of those lighter shades, but there is this guilt within.
Mm-hmm.
And women are, I think psychologically they are trained somewhere to feel guilty about wearing those colors. So a lot of Hindu women end up, you know, not eating meat once they're widows.
Oh.
Yeah, because, you know, the heat from the meat, and that's their school of thought, creates urges. And that's what just completely baffles me. There's enough that the woman is already lost. Now we'll take away pretty much her right to live. She can't wear the colors. You know, she can't eat the food that she wants to. And I know in my aunt's case, no one told her to do these things.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's just so inbred in you. It's so instilled in you.
Exactly.
That the guilt gnaws at you if you partake in any of these fun things, so to say.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Speaking of with colors, I would like you to read one of your poems, and the one that we had spoken about was Aging with Beige, because that really sort of goes into what we were just talking about.
Right. The one thing that I would like to say, Ari, the poem Aging with Beige, the tone of it is, in this case, the woman isn't even widowed. You know, she's a happily married woman in her 60s or her 70s, but the society, again, expects her to sort of mellow down the colors in her wardrobe. So if she waltz around in a red-colored sari, you know, in the middle of the day, it's almost frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, the way I look at it is, it's also with age that your colors change. So it's not just the presence or absence of a man. It's also what stage of your life you're in.
Wow. Interesting. Interesting.
So the title of the poem is Aging with Beige. With a capricious brush, life painted, a portion of shades, in the world around my persona, but colored me with decaying beige, Leonardo stained Mona Lisa. I appear alive. You can smell the flesh and stream of red flowing through my goblet-shaped heart, but take a peek inside the mystique. I'm crumpling, emotions in a knot. A smile adorns my visage, an embalmed cadaver rotting from the inside. Societal worms laying maggots in my soul and gnawing on them until I relinquish all desire. I'm 60, not dead, not beige, color me red.
Wow. Wow. That is powerful.
Thank you.
That is so powerful. And knowing now, you know, as you explain to us how your society, the Hindu society, puts women and labels them, as you're talking about, not only, you know, if they age, then they have to start changing their colors also.
Right. I mean, I would think that it's almost like a global phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's more women than men judging women by the appearances. You know, if a 70-year-old woman walks out wearing an outfit that a 20-year-old woman does, is expected to, in the eyes of the society, be it anywhere in the world, women are the first to always comment on. And my point being, who are we to judge what anyone else wears? It's such a personal choice.
Boy, I'm so on that page with you. And as I'm listening to you, I'm also, you know, reflecting back and to my grandmother and how she dressed. And as she aged, you know, she was getting into darker and darker and darker clothes, and soon she was just wearing black and no color at all. Maybe in the summertime she may wear a white blouse or something, but that's, I just hardly remember seeing her.
Wow.
Yeah, and so, you know, it probably some of this sort of overlaps in, as you say, in all other cultures too.
Right.
And a lot of that, as you mentioned too, is inbred or ingrained or imprinted into us, and, you know, we feel guilty if we sway from it.
I agree with you, and I think not many people take a step back and question traditions.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's always the fear of being called a black sheep. But that said, I don't think, sometimes it's just easier to do things than question it and get into this whole ugly situation. So even if people want to question, sometimes they want to question and, you know, they don't have the opportunity. But I think very often, and I see that even with the younger generation, the idea being, you know, there's so much to be done. May as well just follow these few things and do the rest on our own. So I guess we all pick up priorities in terms of what we question, what we don't agree with.
So speaking of colors, Shweta, the society we live in actually is obsessed with skin color also.
Oh, yes.
So does this actually exist in India and your culture also?
It actually does, you know, but on a different level in that, you know, America being a land of immigrants, so color is viewed on a different level, and people have, because of based on the skin color, have been treated differently. But even in India, there is a lot of prejudice when it comes to skin color. And it really saddens me because beauty is considered directly proportional to the lightness of your skin. If, even in today's day and age, if you read matrimonial columns for traditional arranged marriages, people want, and they are blatant about asking for fair complexion women.
Really?
Yes. You know, and especially like 15 years ago, it was very, very blatant. So in the matrimonial columns, it would say something like, you know, tall, slim, convent educated, fair complexion. So there are just so many whitening creams in it.
Really?
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. We're speaking today with Shweta Vikram, author of Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors. Interesting, isn't it? Until speaking with Shweta right now, I had no idea that in her culture that life was determined by colors. Wow. So continue listening, because we are even going to explore more on this topic. By the way, Shweta's website address is ShvetaVikram.com.
I was in India last week, and when I was growing up, there were these skin lightening creams for women, and because 20 years ago there were more traditional arranged marriages, which, you know, it seems to be a myth in today's world, and even in India. So women, the only way, you know, a woman was considered pretty was if she was good with the household chores and was light skin. And I remember one of my mother's cousins, I was just thinking about her today. She was, you know, by the societal standards, this perfect bride material, but she was darker skin. So she would apply the skin whitening cream and, you know, every proposal would be turned down just because of her skin color. So finally the way she got married was her brother was married to this woman whose brother married my aunt. So in that, like, the brother-sister married another set of brother-sister. And in both these cases, both the women were darker skinned. So it was sort of a compromise for the families. And it just boggles my mind. Like, how can skin color, define a person? How can it make a person good or bad? How do you determine what their nature is just based on the skin color? But what really appalled me was this time when I was there, I realized there are like these skin whitening creams for even men. And it's not just in India. This phenomena is in Asia all over, because my brother lives in Singapore, and, you know, I was talking to them this past visit, and they were like, it's the same craze all over Asia. You know, this hunger for light-skinned people, or for, you know, trying to become light-skinned.
Well, it wasn't long ago that, I guess maybe about a year ago now, we did review a book by an Asian woman that had this recipe on how to lighten the skin, but it was through the internal, and she was using minerals, various minerals.
Wow.
And apparently her skin lightens, and so she was, you know, selling her idea to others as well. So that was the first I've heard of anything like that. And so it just, I don't understand it, but maybe
it's like a prejudice. Again, because it's not like a land of immigrants, so the prejudice is expressed in different ways. But like the hunger is there. And, you know, on one hand, you feel terrible for these women who, by the traditional standards, aren't as light-skinned. But the women who are light-skinned, the kind of comments they hear are, oh, you will have no problems in life because you're light-skinned. So there's prejudice both ways.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking back that I'm white, I'm light.
Right.
And so what did I do? I went out in the sun to get darker.
Right.
You know, and then when this cancer scare came on, so what did I do? I bought creams that would make, you know, put this orange tan on me, and now they've got, you know, you can go and you can go in a booth and they'll spray this tan on you so you can look darker. And it's interesting how, you know, those of us that are very white want to become darker, and those that are dark want to become white.
Right, and I always wonder about who planted these seeds of what makes, how can skin color make a person perfect or imperfect?
No kidding. And now, you know, as I look back, I'm just thinking about myself, too, wanting to get darker. And it's like, why? It's got nothing to do with the outside at all.
Right.
You know, it's your internal. So it's interesting, very interesting. How about reading another poem?
Sure. Wanted to read this poem called Poetry in Flowers.
Yes.
With feet like petals of daffodils dipped in almond milk, mind a butterfly nudged by the toothed leaves of buttercup, I dash to chase the breeze of daisies singing melodies. My marigold heart, a few kisses old, echoes the thunder and confesses to the transient spell of beauty, tulips. Me knows he wasn't a blunder. I prance through memories of gladiolus, or was it mustard fields? Happy was me, but I wilt like Van Gogh's sunflower in captivity until the round of turmeric in the sky serenades me with its color and tulips sing rhythmic words of poetry.
Beautiful. Just beautiful.
Thank you.
It, you know, your writing is phenomenal, and it just, I'm always intrigued with people that can use wordsmithing like you do.
Thank you so much.
So you had mentioned earlier that you were just in India. So let's just go there. When was the last time you were in India?
Normally I end up making a trip to India at least once a year or once in 10 months. But this year has been interesting because I've already been there twice. I was there in January, February, like an overlap, mm-hmm. for a couple of weeks. And I was there last week for about a week or 10 days. My mother got her knee replacement surgery done. So I was there to visit her. Plus, I also taught a class at St. Xavier's College in Mumbai. So, but it's always nice to be back. And it's just incredible. I was there, like, you know, I visited India less than 8 months ago, and, you know, then I went back again last week, and how much things change. It truly is a developing economy, a developing country, and it's just incredible at the rate at which it's growing. From, I mean, the India that I grew up in, I don't recognize that at all.
In what way?
The culture has changed a lot. I almost feel like my friends, you know, people like us who moved here many years ago, mm-hmm. are still frozen in times, hanging on to the India that we grew up in.
Oh.
Versus in terms of, you know, even position of women. Like, when my mother, she was my age, you know, it was still a very patriarchal society. Having said that, it's not that on paper that's changed, but women have a voice today. They're very financially independent. They all have jobs. And, you know, the way they dress up, the ideologies of the society, it's a lot, it's a reflection of the West.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask if you felt that it was the West that has the influence on it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think with the whole, you know, the IT boom in the 90s, the whole concept of geographical boundaries, it's absolutely dissipated. And there's such a confluence. I mean, I see a lot of Indianness in New York, especially. I see these women wear kurtis, which is like long cotton shirts with embroidered stuff. And that's all very Indian. Or even something like yoga, it's getting popular by the minute. And so, of course, you know, it's like it works both ways. Even in India, like right from television shows to you know, the way people dress up or how they conduct themselves, it's very Western now.
How do you feel about that?
I'm getting used to it. I felt a little lost in the beginning because, and I think that's true of anyone. You know, I see my husband's aunts and uncles who moved here 40 years ago. Their memory of India is from the time they moved, so they're frozen in times. And I feel like, you know, I've frozen in times.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, but it wasn't that way when I lived there. And but that's just me being cranky. But I'm getting used to it. I just feel some things have grown at a pace they shouldn't have, but I think that's true of every culture.
The changes that are happening that you're seeing, and, you know, you in the short time that you were there from last week to the time before, do you think that these changes are for the better?
Some of them are, yes, mm-hmm. definitely. But I also feel some of the changes are just too rapid, and that's what scares me a little bit. In terms of, you know, I'm all for women's liberation and the independence, but doing that with, you know, vindictiveness or with a vengeance in mind versus doing it because you believe in it, I think the rhythm of the society changes because of that. Like something as simple as the divorce rates in India have really gone up. And up until 10 years ago, they were much, much lower. So I agree, and I really appreciate that women have a voice today, and they wouldn't put up with, you know, a bad marriage, an abusive husband, or abusive in-laws. But in many cases, there isn't even a reason, because tolerance levels have just gone down.
Uh-huh.
And it's like almost like an in thing. Yeah, we don't get along, that's fine. You know, I'm financially independent, I'll take care of my own. So I almost feel like there has to be a balance in every society in terms of what you compromise on, what you tolerate, and what you don't. And I don't think there's like a fixed recipe or a yes or no answer, but overall I just see like the tolerance levels have gone down.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and obviously in a rapid pace. You talked about arranged marriages, and is that still something that is quite prevalent in India?
You know, India is very determined by its socioeconomic groups.
Uh-huh.
So in certain groups it might be, but like the middle class, the upper middle class, it's more of a rare phenomena. And even if it is an arranged marriage, it isn't the way, you know, things happened in my mother's generation where the bride and the groom met on the day of the wedding. There were enough marriages where, you know, right when they were exchanging garlands is when the guy and the groom saw, the girl and the boy saw each other. In today's world, even if it happens, it's more like, you know, someone from the family might be a facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are busy and, you know, girls are no longer, like, pretending to, you know, look pretty for the guy's side or, you know, use these whitening creams and things like that. Just to look pretty for the boys. They might do it for themselves,
mm-hmm.
but it's not because just so the groom's side when he comes over to see the girl, it's not to look pretty then. So I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. You had mentioned socioeconomic and the different levels. So I'm wondering, and going back to the changes, the rapid changes that are happening, Is this affecting some of the groups that just are not able to move as fast?
I think the group that is moving the fastest is the middle class.
Uh-huh.
People, you know, the richer society, the upper echelon, they've always been there. And because the middle class is growing, it pulls up with it. And that's my take on it, you know,
mm-hmm.
by just interacting with my family members in India. They are able to pull up people from, you know, people below the poverty line. Like, for instance, the society is made of, you know, like, my the maid coming home to clean or cook or the chauffeur, for that matter. So they're getting better salaries. And with the women working now, there's more help required and they can afford it. So they're employing more people. So I think it all trickles down and works well overall. But then again, that could be just my take on it, or I might be biased towards my family because from where I stand, I see them doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't just kept the wealth to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, you know, getting one person to do the job, if they're getting two people, they're two people getting employed. And the other thing I see with both my mother and my mother-in-law is like, they end up paying for the tuition fee of, you know, the help who comes home, her kids' tuition fee, or put them through college, things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great to hear that. So, Shweta, Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors, your book.
Yes.
What was the message that you were really hoping to convey to your readers?
The core message was, you know, that colors, they play a very important role in all of our lives. And, you know, this book in particular is about, from a Hindu woman's perspective, that said, you know, from birth until death, colors sort of govern, you know, or rather they dictate what stage she's going through. And that's what I was trying to
mm-hmm.
get across in my book.
Well, you certainly did.
Oh, thank you.
You certainly did. All right. Website address. Tell our listeners your website address.
So it's www.shwetavikram.com. It's S as in Sam, W as in water, E as in echo, T as in Tom, A as in apple, V as in Victor, I as in India, K as in kite, R as in Roger, A as in apple, M as in Mary.
There you go, listeners, shwetavikram.com. And I tell you, I just can't help but keep saying I love the way you write. I love
Thank you so much, Irene.
And so, listeners, there you go. I really encourage you to pick up this book, Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors by Shweta Vikram, and just take a little time and sit back and read each one. Her wordsmithing, as I mentioned, I just can't help but talk about it over and again, is so great. And also, she also has another book of poetry, Because All Is Not Lost, just as beautiful, just as beautiful. And again, listeners, thank you very much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed meeting Shweta. She's an interesting young woman, and her writing is superb. Thanks again, Shweta. I really enjoyed having you on the show again.
Thank you so much, Irene, for having me on the show, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Really appreciate it.
And this is Irene Watson for Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.